I'm Peter Suderman, and this is The Reason Rundown, the podcast to end your week. One Reason journalist, one big story, once a week. Thanks for listening. Last week, former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was assassinated by a lone gunman while giving a political speech. The precise motivation for this horrific killing remains murky, with some reports suggesting the killer was mad about Abe's connections to the Unification Church. But the method has sparked some discussion about violent crime and its causes. That's because Abe was shot with a gun in a country with some of the strictest gun laws in the Western world. Japanese civilians are largely prohibited from gun ownership except for hunting.
Masaomi Nishigaki is here to buy a shotgun, but it's been a lengthy process, starting with a class, followed by a written test. After that, there was a skills test at a range.
Not surprisingly, gun ownership is quite rare in Japan, with only about one gun for every 300 residents. The United States, in contrast, has about 1.2 guns per person. So that's about 400 times as many guns per person as in Japan. But Abe's killer didn't use a factory-made firearm. Instead, he built a homemade weapon out of parts readily available at hardware supply stores, like duct tape and PVC pipe. News reports have indicated that the killer had several more homemade weapons at his residence.
Let me tell you what. This was all made at home out of regular stuff from the hardware store that required no background check, and it is just as deadly and lethal as any gun that you can buy in a gun store.
Some analysts have suggested that Abe's killing, however awful, nevertheless highlights the success of Japanese gun controls, since it serves as a reminder of how rare gun crime is in Japan.
I was very shocked because gun shot very not normally in Japan.
Especially Japan, it's not like America.
Guns are very strictly regulated here. There's a lot of debate about that around the world, but gun crime was virtually non-existent in Japan.
But my guest today sees this another way. Even in an island nation where private gun ownership is essentially outlawed, a determined killer can still find a way to obtain or make a firearm. This, in turn, has implications for current debates about American gun policy.
It's unbelievably safe in Japan in comparison to the United States.
It's a MAC-10 I made out of construction waste, basically. There's not one part on here, really, that didn't come from the garbage.
My guest is Jacob Sullum, a senior editor at Reason, as well as a nationally syndicated columnist and the author of many books. Jacob, let's start with the basic correlation here. Japan does have many fewer guns, not just in total, but per person than the United States. And it also has much lower rates of gun crime. So is this really just a simple story of fewer guns, less crime?
I don't think it's as simple as that, because Japan has an extremely low crime rate in general. So even if you take out all of the U.S. Homicides that are committed with guns, the U.S. still has a much higher homicide rate than Japan, meaning just looking at murders that are committed with knives or blunt instruments or hands and fists, Japan has a much lower homicide rate, has a much lower violent crime rate. Muggings are very rare compared to the United States and most other countries. Robberies, assaults. So this is not just a question of guns, although obviously the fact that guns are very difficult to obtain means that when crimes are committed, they're less likely to be used. The real puzzle is why Japan is such a peaceful society in general, which clearly goes beyond the gun regulations, because you can take that totally out of the equation and you still have these enormous differences.
So do you think that is primarily a cultural difference? Is it a legal difference? Is there something else going on here? How would you explain the difference in violent crime, even apart from gun regulations?
Well, Dave Koppel at the Independence Institute, who's an expert on gun policy and has been writing about Japan in particular for more than 30 years now, I think, he argues that both the Japanese people's willingness to comply with the gun laws and their very low crime rate can be traced to a spirit of conformity and a deference to authority. And that leads to a couple of implications for the gun control debate. One is that you can't simply attribute the low crime rate in Japan to the fact that they very strictly regulate firearms. And the other is that you can't expect the sort of compliance that you see in Japan with strict gun laws in the United States. The United States has a much different tradition related to firearms and other weapons than Japan does. In Japan, for centuries, weapons, not just guns, but swords as well, have been strictly regulated, traditionally reserved for the upper classes. And there is not the same tradition of gun ownership in Japan as there is in the United States. Even leaving aside, you know, the Second Amendment, obviously they have no Second Amendment, they have no constitutional right to arms. They just don't have a tradition of allowing common people to possess guns and other weapons for self-defense. So that's a huge difference. And that's related to the other obvious difference, which you mentioned, is that there's an enormous number of guns already in circulation in the United States. You have more than 400 million guns, so more than a gun per person. And even if it weren't for the Second Amendment, policymakers would still have to contend with those facts. It's just beyond the realm of political possibility, even leaving aside the legality of it, to expect that the U.S. could impose the kind of restrictions on guns that they have in Japan.
So I want to drill down just a little bit on this idea of a spirit of conformity. It seems like an awfully difficult thing to prove. And yet, I don't think anyone would say that there aren't real and significant cultural differences between the United States and Japan. But it's very, I mean, this isn't something that you can do a study to prove that Japanese willingness to comply is somehow baked into Japanese culture, right? It's something where you have a sensibility about it, right? Where you have this notion that it's true. How do you understand that difference? I mean, you've cited Dave Koppel on this. Do you think that that is accurate? Do you think that that is a good explanation for the difference here?
I don't know if it's a complete explanation. It seems plausible to me. I mean, you have, you know, widespread compliance with the law, compliance with police. Koppel also points out that the police themselves tend not to use guns. So you have an example being set where people don't assume that that's an appropriate response to threats, even generally speaking, for police. They tend to rely more on martial arts and in encounters with dangerous people, which, again, happens. Those encounters happen much less frequently than they do in the United States. So I think there's something to Koppel's idea. I mean, you also have a much more homogeneous society. That probably factors into it, although I suppose you could have a homogeneous society where everyone's violent. So it's not just that. But, you know, there are big differences in culture and history that help account for these really big differences in crime rates. And it's clearly not just a matter of the gun restrictions you have. Now, you could argue, if you could magically make all the guns in the U.S. disappear, wouldn't that have an effect on violent crime? It probably would, right? So some people will substitute other weapons. There will be a lot of substitution. So it's not like it's not like eliminating all of the murders that currently take place with firearms, which would be, it's roughly 3/4 of U.S. homicides. It's not like you would, reduce the number of homicides by 75%, but you could expect there would be some reduction even with substitution, because people would have less access to more lethal weapons, right? So that's plausible. But the main point is that's never going to happen. it's impossible. It's politically impossible, legally impossible, practically impossible. So if you're talking about what policies are actually doable, you have to look at what the marginal impact would be. And all of the policies that people tend to talk about, which poll very well in general, things like expanded background checks or red flag laws or bans on so-called assault weapons or so-called large capacity magazines, all those things are very popular when you ask people about them in polls. somewhat less popular, which is interesting when you actually put it to a vote in a ballot initiative. There is a gap between the support that people voice in polls and what they actually do when they get into voting booths, which is interesting because I think at that point they're probably paying more attention to the implications of the policies and their costs and benefits. But in any case, you have a number of policies that are widely popular as measured by polls. But even if you implemented all of them, you're not going to have much impact on criminal access to guns. The main impact is going to be on people who follow the law, which makes sense, right? Criminals have lots of ways to obtain guns that are extra legal or illegal. That is the main way they get them now. It's not by going to a gun shop and going through a background check. So the problem that you have, the practical problem you have with imposing these gun controls in the United States is that the people who will follow those rules are not the people you're worried about. And the people you are worried about don't care about following the law. So you have a disproportionate effect. So that you're having more, you're imposing mainly a burden on law-abiding people who might want guns to protect themselves against violent criminals, whereas the violent criminals are not gonna follow the law, and there's not gonna be much impact on their access to weapons given the ways they generally get them.
So the point you seem to be sort of circling around here is that the sheer number of guns in the United States just presents a real problem for anyone who is trying to implement gun control schemes like they have in Japan. But also, I think, you know, and even getting there is a problem, right? So gun control advocates often point to an Australian gun buyback program that happened a couple of decades ago. And by most estimates, that program took about 25 or 30% of the country's guns out of private hands. Most of those guns that were returned to the government were shotguns or rimfire rifles, which is notable. They didn't get a lot of pistols. They didn't get a lot of, you know, what we might call assault rifles, as murky as that category is. But imagine if somehow or another you could surmount the constitutional issues to have a gun buyback program in the United States. Obviously, I think there would be huge Second Amendment issues. There are 400 million guns, give or take, in America. So even if you managed to implement an Australian-style buyback program in the United States, you'd still end up with somewhere in the vicinity, very roughly, of 300 million guns. You would still have a huge number of firearms in private hands. And it would, if the Australia model is sort of is suggestive, it would mostly be people who have shotguns, who have pea shooter type rifles, who would be complying with a buyback program. And so I just sort of always wonder, what is it that gun control advocates who think, well, you know, the solution is to have a Japan-style regime where basically private citizens can't own firearms except, you know, in very strict circumstances for hunting. What is it? How is it that they think they are going to get there?
I'm not sure. I don't often hear good arguments in favor of the policies that are typically proposed. I mean, if you could have a really big impact on the supply of weapons, that might affect access to guns by criminals. But I don't see any practical or legal way to do that. And you have to always keep in mind that you're disproportionately disarming law-abiding people. The criminals are highly motivated to obtain guns, and they have lots of ways to do that. So even if you reduce the supply by 75% or 90%, there still would be plenty of guns available to criminals. Now, maybe it would have an impact on people who don't know how to get guns in an unapproved way, right? So maybe some mass shooters who are unfamiliar with informal sources of obtaining weapons, maybe some of them would be deterred. That's possible. But again, the premise is totally fantastical, the idea that you're going to have that kind of impact on the gun supply. And I would mention, by the way, there's a dispute as to what impact Australia's policy actually had on violent crime. But it's worth noting that Australia has a homicide rate several times as high as Japan. So do other countries that have similarly strict gun laws, like Germany, the UK. Russia actually has strict gun laws compared to the United States, and they have a much higher homicide rate, not just than Japan, but also higher than the US, right? right? So these international comparisons are very tricky because people, whatever argument they're making, people tend to want to assume that it's just the one factor that's important, but there obviously are a lot of other things going on.
So I think the example of alcohol prohibition in the United States is actually instructive here. There are sometimes you hear libertarians or anti-prohibitionists say, well, it didn't reduce drinking at all. And that's actually not true. It did. Prohibition reduced alcohol consumption by somewhere in the range of 30 or 40% in the country. That's a pretty big drop. But most of the reduction in drinking, if you look at the statistics, actually came from people who we wouldn't describe as problem drinkers. They were casual drinkers who, you know, had a glass of wine with dinner, and they just stopped for, you know, a decade and a half. And at the same time, the alcohol supply became more dangerous. People moved from beer to hard liquor, right, to stronger stuff, often adulterated, in some cases dangerous. And I think there's probably, you know, sort of a similar story that you would expect to see in a gun prohibition regime where, yes, you would see, you know, sort of fewer people would own guns and this would have an effect probably on crime stats, but it would produce other unintended consequences, particularly given that people can now relatively easily build their own firearms, as Shinzo Abe's assassin did. And there's also now 3D printing available. And so talk to me just a little bit about how you see this, right? This wasn't a 3D printed gun. This was just, you know, this was duct tape, PVC pipe. I mean, I think there was like a wooden board of some sort there, right? It looked like it was something you found, you might find on a, you know, a house construction site. But 3D printing now does allow people to make lowers for guns. And that changes the calculus here too. I mean, so to me, I just sort of see this as an example of, even if you are in an island nation with near total restrictions, people can still find ways to get access to firearms if they are sufficiently motivated, right?
Yes. I mean, and the way it's analogous to alcohol prohibition in the sense that, as you mentioned, the main impact was on people who weren't really a problem. The heavy drinkers are the ones who are least deterred by prohibition. Same thing goes for the war on drugs. It's the people who are most inclined to abuse drugs who are least deterred by prohibition. And in a similar way, if you have gun prohibition or strict gun controls, the people who are most deterred are the people who are not the problem. They're law-abiding people. And the people who are least deterred are criminals who are highly motivated to get guns. And if they are reduced to actually making their own, that is a viable option. It's not, you know, it obviously involves more cost and inconvenience. The gun that was used in Japan is not a great gun. I mean, this is basically a couple of pipes that are bound together, and it looks like he used shotgun ammunition, so it can fire twice before you have to reload. It's not clear what the firing mechanism actually was. I haven't seen any details on that, but the real question for me when it comes to Japan is, why don't people do that more often, right? It's so hard to get guns. You could basically, you can smuggle them. You could smuggle factory-made firearms. That's relatively difficult. But making zip guns like this is pretty straightforward, but it almost never happens, right? So this, again, goes to the point that to have lots of gun crime, guns are not sufficient. You have to have lots of people who are inclined to commit violent crimes. And the rarity of this sort of crime, not just assassinations, but any kind of gun crime, any kind of crime with other weapons, whether it's homemade guns or knives or blunt instruments or anything else, it's just very, very rare in Japan. So despite the fact that there are alternatives, people generally are not using them. So it's clearly not just a matter of access, to weapons, but yeah.
Yeah. It does seem like there is a difficult to pin down yet real cultural difference at play here, which brings me to another salient data point that you've written about, which regards suicide. So gun death data is notoriously messy. Our colleague Brian Doherty did a great cover story for this for a reason on this just a few years ago. But one of the clearest correlations, at least stateside, has to do with suicide. States with higher rates of gun ownership do seem to have higher rates of suicide. And that's, you know, maybe not that surprising, if only because a firearm is an extremely effective way to commit suicide. But as you note in one of the pieces you've written, Japan with its very low rate of private gun ownership, actually has a higher suicide rate than the United States.
Yeah.
What do you think that tells us?
Well, we're delving again into sort of hard to pin down cultural factors. But the first thing it tells us is that controlling guns in Japan did not have the effect that you would predict based on the arguments you hear in the United States. They have a relatively high suicide rate, despite the fact that it's nearly impossible to legally own a gun in Japan. So people obviously are using other means. So the speculation about why does Japan have a relatively high suicide rate also has to do with cultural factors. And you go back to this spirit of conformity, the idea that if you are not if you're not conforming, if you're not accepted, if you're not viewed as doing what you're supposed to do, that you might be more inclined to kill yourself in Japan than Americans might be. So that's one theory. I have no idea whether that's true or not, but clearly something is going on, right? I mean, and you see, again, variation in suicide rates across countries. It is not neatly correlated with the kinds of gun laws that they have. Russia, which has a very high homicide rate, also has a very high suicide rate. And you can speculate about why that is, why Russians are so miserable and so inclined to kill themselves. But it's clearly not just a matter of gun regulations.
So all of this obviously comes at a time when the U.S. is mired in its own debates about gun policy. There's been an awful streak of horrific high-profile mass shootings, as well as a Supreme Court decision striking down a New York State gun control law. And as a result, we've seen a lot of proposals to clamp down on gun ownership in the states. One of those proposals, red flag laws, which basically allow friends or family members to report someone who may appear to be dangerous, and then local authorities may take that person's guns away. But it's worth looking, I think, at gun policy in Illinois following the July 4th shooting in Highland Park. Illinois has a red flag law on the book already, and the shooter was already known to authorities. He had even reportedly made some threats of violence, I believe, to his family. So what happened there? And what can we learn about the efficacy of red flag laws, which even have some supporters on the right? I mean, people who are sort of nominally conservative gun rights supporters.
Well, I think the main lesson from Illinois is that politicians who support these laws are really overpromising. In theory, they can make a difference. But even in cases where there are what appear in retrospect to be very clear red flags, and even when you have a red flag law, you don't necessarily get a court order. What happened in this particular case is that the perpetrator, when he was, I think, 18 initially, when he first came to the attention of police, there was a report that he had tried to kill himself. Police came to his home. A while later, there was a report that he had gotten into an argument with his family and threatened to kill everyone. Police came by again. Now, they didn't make any arrests. There was no probable cause for an arrest, but the local police did report the incident to the state police. And the state police did not take any further action for two reasons. They said he did not have a firearm owner's ID card, which you need in Illinois to legally own a gun. So there was nothing to revoke. He had not applied for an ID card, so there was no application to reject. And furthermore, which I think is crucial, is that nobody in the family and no one else was willing to either file a petition for a red flag order, which prevents you from legally owning a gun or acquiring a gun for a specified period of time. Nobody was willing to file the petition or even to support a petition that the police might have filed. So the initial test to get a temporary order, which is supposed to be in an emergency situation where somebody poses an imminent threat, is pretty weak. You just need probable cause. In the case of Illinois, probable cause to believe that this person poses an imminent threat, or that he will, if you don't take action now, which is the reason for dispensing with a hearing, that he might either kill himself or kill somebody else. Now, maybe based on those police reports, they could have gotten that initial order. That lasts up to 2 weeks. then you there's a hearing, and then the respondent finally gets a chance to actually respond and rebut the allegations against him, say, no, I'm not really a danger to myself. I'm not suicidal. I'm not a threat to anyone else. And the judge considers that evidence. And then you need clear and convincing evidence that the person poses a threat to himself or others in the near future. In Illinois, they actually specify that it's in the near future, which makes sense, right? And those orders last for 6 months, and they can be renewed if you make that same showing again. He continues to pose this threat, right? So they never filed a petition. They, without the family's cooperation, it's hard to see how they could present clear and convincing evidence. And even if they had filed a petition, and even if it had been granted, it would have lasted 6 months. So, and this was several years before the crime. So it would have had to be renewed over and over again in order to have actually blocked the sale of the gun that was used in the massacre. It's highly improbable that would have happened. So you have all of these limitations that make it unlikely that even if the red flag law had been invoked, it would have made a difference. Another issue was when he initially was buying guns, he was younger than 21, so he needed the permission or the consent of a parent or guardian in order to get that firearm owner's ID card, and his father sponsored him. And that's really striking, right? The father did not think there was any issue. Presumably, if he thought that his son was a potential mass murderer, he would not have agreed to sponsor his application or to consent to his application. But he turned 21 before he committed this crime several months before. I think it was last September he turned 21. So at that point, he wouldn't have needed his father's consent, right? So even if the father had not gone along with this, he still could have bought the guns, right? So that just, it just sort of illustrates the reasons why we should not have unrealistic expectations about these laws. Theoretically, they can work in some situations, but there are going to be many cases where people slip by, and I would say for good reasons. What I mean by that is not necessarily a family that doesn't know what's going on with their son, but you need due process protections when you're talking about taking away somebody's constitutional rights, even if it's just for 6 months, or more typically it's for a year. You want to have reasonable standards of evidence. You want to give him an opportunity to rebut the allegations against him, and you don't want to rush to judgment. That makes sense. Even the best evidence in support of these laws, which is not very good, doesn't pertain to murder, does not pertain to homicide. There's very little evidence that these laws actually reduce violent crime. There's some evidence that they reduce suicides. But if you look at those studies, what they suggest to you is that for every 100 people who lose their Second Amendment rights, maybe 5 would have killed themselves, right? And this is hard to, this is a sort of a counterfactual speculation, but these are their estimates from the studies. So maybe 5 people. So that means when you make the decision to take away somebody's Second Amendment rights, there's a 95% probability that he never would have harmed himself or anyone else. Is that, you know, is a 5% risk good enough? I mean, these are the kind of judgments you have to make when you're setting up these laws. So the two problems with the arguments for these laws are, first, they overestimate the potential benefits. And second, they underestimate the costs, which are definite. You know that you're going to be taking away the rights of many innocent people who never would have harmed anyone. You know that for a fact. And then the question is just, you know, how many? And that is depends on the rules you set up, right? So the tendency always is, because people, the threat of not just a murder, but a mass murder is what looms in people's minds. The tendency for everyone, people who support the laws, the tendency for the legislators who pass the laws, and the tendency for the judges who apply them is to err on the side of what they take to be caution, which is, we don't know if this guy's actually dangerous, but why take the chance, right? That's sort of the built-in incentive for everybody. And that totally discounts the due process concerns and the risk of depriving innocent people of their constitutional rights.
Yeah, so I mean, I do think that probably a lot of gun control advocates might take that trade-off. But in many cases, they wouldn't recognize it as a trade-off. And it very much is one, right? And given the constitutional protections for gun ownership, I think this is a bigger deal than gun control advocates often seem to think. But I just sort of want to ask you about solutions here, right? It does seem like we consistently see appalling headline-making shootings, incidents that should make any person with like a functioning heart just deeply upset. And then in response, we see politicians, mostly Democrats, but not always, call for gun restrictions that are almost entirely irrelevant to the specifics of the situations they are designed to respond to. Why do you think that impulse has become such a consistent feature of American gun policy debates?
Well, I think it's understandable that people want to believe that if you just have the right combination of regulations, that you can prevent these horrifying crimes. People want to believe that, and politicians encourage that belief. It's not true. So that's the main problem. And I always, you know, I'm always asked, well, what's your solution? I don't have any kind of easy, simple solution. In the minds of some of my critics, that means I have no business even talking about this if I don't have a solution. It's a complicated issue that's very hard to tackle given the background realities. And by that, I mean what we were talking about earlier, all of the guns already in circulation, constraints imposed by the Second Amendment and other parts of the Constitution as well, Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment. Given all that background, there are real limits on what you can hope to accomplish by passing another law. And so one example is background checks. We mentioned red flag laws. Background checks. Seems to make sense. Most people agree anytime there's a gun transfer, there should be a background check, even if it's a private transfer, right? And this will help prevent mass murders. You know, maybe, but not very often, because the vast majority of people who commit these crimes do not have disqualifying records. That's the first thing to realize. So, and in fact, over and over again, we see people walking into gun shops, undergoing background checks, passing the background checks, and then killing a bunch of people, right? So clearly, background checks are not even close to an adequate response. The policy that the Congress recently enacted, it doesn't expand background checks to all transfers, but it says if somebody's younger than 21 and they're buying a gun, then the background check should include their juvenile records, right? And so I wondered about that. Would that work? And I looked at a bunch of really notorious mass murders that were committed by people younger than 21, and I didn't find any cases where that would have made a difference. In other words, it only makes a difference, first of all, if somebody is going to be undergoing a background check. So that leaves out anybody who gets guns from family members or from older acquaintances. These are actual cases where this happens. Or anybody who does not, in fact, have a disqualifying juvenile record. So you would have to have a criminal record for a crime that's punishable by more than a year in prison. That's the rule for adults, right? So it would be applied to juveniles as well. And under this, the law that Congress passed, if you had been committed, if you'd been subjected to involuntary psychiatric treatment when you were 16 or older, that would also disqualify you. In none of these cases that I looked at, now there may be some, maybe I missed some, would either of those factors have applied, right? So people, politicians pretend like they're doing something, but then when you actually ask, in what way would this make a difference, they have no answer.
These laws just mostly become burdens on people exercising their constitutional rights rather than successful ways of stopping or reducing gun crime. But we've talked a lot about policy here. And before we go, I want to just sort of ask you a bigger picture question. I think there is something deeper here, a kind of social divide that manifests in our politics, but isn't exactly political. On one side, people think of guns and gun ownership as tools, as sport, and as fundamental rights and duties to, you know, a way of protecting yourself, your family, and your property. And then there's this other side that understands gun ownership almost entirely as a deadly, reckless obsession, right? Just something that's not worth indulging for the sake of somebody's sport or hobby. So before we sign off here, I want to ask, how do you bridge that cultural gap? Is there a way for these two sides to talk to each other more productively?
Possibly. I mean, a book idea I'm working on actually tries to do something like that by exploring the parallels between gun control and drug control. And what's striking about those policies is that they pose many of the same problems. They impose similar burdens. They are similar threats to civil liberties. But whereas people on the left tend to be very much aware of the downside of the war on drugs, and in particular, its disproportionate racial impact, when it comes to gun control, they seem almost completely oblivious to those problems. And conversely, people on the right, if they support gun rights, which they tend to do, are very much concerned about, you know, criminalizing a conduct that doesn't violate anybody's rights, about aggressive law enforcement, about Fourth Amendment issues, about unjust punishments, all that sort of thing when it comes to gun rights. But they tend not to think very much about how the war on drugs raises those same issues. So in many respects, the people on the left and the right are actually talking about the same issues. It's just that they are arbitrarily focusing on one particular item the government is trying to either ban or restrict, and not the other category. So I think that there's potential there. I hope so. And I guess the other approach that I would try to take with people on the left who tend to be repelled by guns is that you're talking about a fundamental human right, which without which you really can't exercise any other rights, which is to preserve your own life, which implies a right to self-defense, and given, you know, current realities, implies a right to armed self-defense, and that's what the Second Amendment guarantees. It's not about hunting and target shooting. So you can certainly tell compelling stories about actual people of color in, you know, low-income neighborhoods that are plagued by crime, who are not protected by the police, and at the same time are prevented from protecting themselves by these arbitrary laws. And in the case you mentioned, where the Supreme Court ruled against New York's restrictions on public possession of guns, there were several groups that submitted briefs arguing against the law, who made these points that you're talking about laws that have a disproportionate impact on poor people, on Black people, people who live, you know, in dangerous neighborhoods, who not only are not protected by the police and not only are told they can't protect themselves, but when they try to protect themselves illegally, they get arrested for it. Now they have a felony record. So that's, you know, I think that people on the left should be able to see that is unjust, that there's something wrong with that.
Well, we can hope, and I think it's good to end on a hopeful note. Jacob Sullum, thank you for joining me. That is all the time we have this week. If you like this show, please remember to subscribe and recommend it to friends. As always, if you like this podcast or Reasons Work generally, you can support us at reason.com/donate. That's reason.com/donate. I'm Peter Suderman, and this has been The Reason Rundown.